From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I just want to write something today. But of course, then the pandemic hit, and you're like, what is that going to even look like? Is everyone going to be wearing masks? Are we going to be in quarantine? Like, to write a show set contemporary world has its own obstacles now that I hadn't even considered.
Dobby Waller wrote for Mad Men and Halt and Catch Fire before creating the FX limited series Mrs. America about the 1970s battle over the Equal Rights Amendment. After working on three meticulously crafted period dramas, Waller was thinking she was ready to set her next project in the present. But is she? Waller talks about tackling the complicated character of Phyllis Schlafly, the woman who led the movement that ultimately blocked ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, and the complications of finishing post-production on Mrs. America while under stay-at-home orders. But first on the News Banter, is Universal going to keep the window open? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my regular partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So as you may recall, as you have a toddler, in April, Universal said, hey, we are going to put Trolls, which was poised for a theatrical release, on demand for $20, give or take. And, you know, you have a 48-hour window to watch it. You're home with your kids and your kids are bouncing off the walls and you will do almost anything. So we're doing this. This has been a thing where many people, we've talked about it before, say, well, why don't they put all the movies on demand? Well, the reason is because many of them are much too expensive and you will never, ever, it is believed and I think will be demonstrated, get that back when you're charging $20 on demand. Now, Universal just bruited this past week. We have had $100 million in rentals and this is a record breaker. And as Jeff Shell, the head of NBC Universal, said, this proves that this premium video on demand thing proves the viability, and we will release movies on both formats. The theaters immediately said, I'm sorry, what? Because theaters, as you know, Matt, they are protecting their window. They want the movie exclusively in their theaters. They then split that money with the studios, and that is where you generate gigantic numbers, and that is why you don't see even Universal's not going to be putting the next Fast and Furious movie on demand. But what Jeff Shell said alarmed them as an attack on the windows to the point where AMC said, well, that's fine, Universal. We will never play your movies again.
Yeah, I mean, this escalated very quickly. And, you know, a lot was written about this being World War III and that the future of the movie business is on the line. What I think is actually at work here is this is the opening salvo in a negotiation. Jeff Shell, who just took over the CEO position at NBC Universal, he came up through the Comcast system, was a Comcast guy, ran the film division for about 5 years, and now is in charge of the entirety of NBC Universal. And he wants to shorten the theatrical window, and he wants to be able to have more freedom to release different kinds of movies in different kinds of ways. And the big impediment to that is the theater owners. And what I anticipate is that this is going to be a negotiation going back and forth, and that we will, coming out of this pandemic, have some kind of new agreement or relationship between the studios and the theaters where maybe they get cut in on VOD, maybe they come to a different understanding for different kinds of movies. But I do think that this situation is going to lead to some change.
Well, certainly it seems that way. I mean, Jeff Shell did choose his words in a way. He said, we expect to release movies on both formats. You know, if you think the end of that sentence is on the same day, then you have a breakdown. If you're in the theaters, if you think it's even not with our traditional window, you have a breakdown. The thing that I'm sort of stuck on is a little bit of this impression that they did 100 million in rentals and therefore they've made money. I think a lot of people have sort of accepted that as obviously 100 million and they get to keep more of it than they would if they had to split it with theater owners. So people think they must have made money. I think not, based on my reporting. This movie is on a much more expensive end than most of the movies that are being moved into on demand. It was probably give or take $90 to $100 million, let's say. We know they spent maybe close to $40 million to market it domestically, thinking it would be released theatrically. So when you're looking at those kind of numbers and potentially losses of things that would normally follow a traditional theatrical release, normally on demand is one of the things that follows theatrical release? Well, that's going to be gone. All of these questions have people wondering whether Universal actually lost money, but is putting this spin on it because they want to make it sound, you know, like a huge win that everybody should then follow this pattern.
Yeah, and Jeff Schell is clearly taking advantage of a pretty unique situation. I mean, you have a movie that did have a traditional marketing campaign associated with it. So there were billboards, TV ads, there was the whole kit and caboodle before the pandemic. So it benefited from that full marketing campaign.
And Matt, it's a then sequel. You have, it's a known property. It's not just like, what is that? It's Trolls.
Right, of course. Exactly. And my kid was aware of it. My kid was very aware of it, but also from the billboard that's on Pico and Barrington that was, you know, screaming Trolls 2 for, you know, a month and a half before it was available on demand. And the second point is that every kid is now trapped at home with their parents. And these, you know, this is a very unique situation where there is not that level of premium movie that you've never seen before on demand available in the home very often. This is a unique situation. So, of course, these numbers are spiking upward. I think Universal is trying to project out into the future a very unicorn-like situation here because it suits their ultimate goal, which is to have more flexibility in how they release their films and to reduce the influence of the theater lobby, which has prevented them from doing that.
In fairness to Universal, I would say $100 million so far, that's good. It's not good enough for this to be, as you say, some across-the-board meaningful thing with this particular set of circumstances. And, you know, having shot that sentence out there about we will be doing this going forward, Universal then backpedaled and said, you know, we absolutely believe in theaters. They didn't quite do it the way Tom Rothman did it when he was putting movies into that on-demand space. He bent over it, you know, more than backwards to say, we love theaters. We would never mess with theaters. Theaters are our darling in life. He wasn't looking for that kind of trouble. Jeff Schell was a little more aggressive, and then he had to walk it back a little bit.
Right. And if you look at their 2021, Universal has three sequels, a sequel to Fast and Furious, a sequel to Minions, and a sequel to Jurassic World. All of those movies made over $1 billion in theaters in their previous installments. Universal needs the theaters to release those movies in order to get the kind of return that funds the entire studio. So this will never get to the point where AMC will not release those movies. Universal cannot afford that.
AMC, like many theaters, is on the brink and they need it, and Universal needs it too. So it will be hammered out. I of course, you know, I'll just mention on my way out here, who knows when we're going back to theaters and how, if it's 25% full, is it worth opening the theater? And what are they playing? What's being released with 25% capacity, as many people are talking about for theaters? So much, much, much more to be revealed, but we'll be here to banter it. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new FX on Hulu series, Mrs. America, follows feminist icons, including Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Bella Abzug, and Shirley Chisholm, as they struggled to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed and ratified over the course of the 1970s. At first, it looked like they were headed for an easy win. The amendment had broad bipartisan support. Then came the backlash, led by Phyllis Schlafly and her following of conservative housewives. Before taking on the ERA, Schlafly had twice lost bids to win a seat in Congress. She was known for her intense support of Barry Goldwater and her criticisms of America's defense strategy, though she had a tough time getting people, mostly male politicians, to take her seriously. With her attack on women's rights, however, she finally landed on an attention-grabbing topic. Here, Schlafly, played by Cate Blanchett, finds a rapt audience at a mother-daughter luncheon.
Today, I am not going to talk about the Soviet military threat, but rather another threat. A threat to the traditional American family. A threat that is just as dangerous and even more insidious. The threat of the women's liberation movement.
Thanks in large part to Schlafly's army of homemakers, the ERA fell three states short of ratification. The creator of Mrs. America is Davi Waller, who, of course, never imagined she'd be launching her show during a global crisis.
So we, when the pandemic hit and the shelter in place started, we luckily had locked picture on the finale, but we still had to score a lot of music cues. All the episodes had to be mixed. We still hadn't done color correction, sound effects, some ADR sessions. We're having like an ADR session with someone in France on their phone. So within a couple of days, we had to move out of the office where post-production is and have all the editors working remotely, our mixers working remotely. So I'm kind of used to this setup where I'm on Skype in a session and I'm watching the video streaming and we're doing a mix that way. It's a whole new world.
Did you feel like you got it where you wanted it? Was there any sacrifice or did you have to go, okay, that's the way it's going to have to be?
I have to say that I do feel like I got exactly where I wanted it. We have an incredible team. I cannot believe, I already was in awe of our post team, but the way they've rallied and figured things out. I mean, really the hardest part is everything takes 10 times as long. So for our composer, Chris Bowers, rather than having the entire orchestra in a recording studio, he's literally recording them each individually from their home and directing them each individually and then making it sound like an orchestra. So that just takes so much more time.
Wow. So you had to do all of this stuff remotely, which you executed and amazing. But also, you actually ended up streaming on FX on Hulu, which when you were originally FX, and I don't know whether that because of the pandemic, whatever. I mean, I don't know what your reaction to that or how that went down.
So you're right. When we sold this project to FX, it was back in 2015. In fact, we wrote all the episodes thinking this is going to be on FX. It's going to be broadcast traditionally. And then we got a call from John Landgraf right before it was announced.
The head of FX and now FX on Hulu, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you hear you're getting a call from the head of the network and you're in post-production, you're thinking, this can't be good. So when he told us that we were moving to Hulu, we're like, oh, that's great. That's a great platform. So I was actually thrilled. I just felt the audience at Hulu was perfect for the show. So it was good. You know, we always broke the story to be a seamless 1 hour. You know, I don't really write to like commercial act breaks anyway. So that didn't really affect how we had crafted the story in any way. I am happy that Hulu shows one episode per week after the first three, because I do think it's the kind of show that benefits from dropping one episode a week and having conversations around each episode rather than the entire series dropping. So I was really happy that they have this hybrid rollout where they drop the first three episodes at once, but then each episode is week by week. It was really nice.
Yeah. So going back to the original FX idea, I don't know how many places you went to with it. I know that it was kind of long gestating because you spent a couple of years with the concept, just, you know, sort of figuring out how you wanted to do it.
So my producer, Stacey Scherer, had a deal at FX. So we went first to pitch it to FX because they had a first look and they bought the idea in the room. So we ended up at FX right away. Then was the long, as you say, gestational period, which I've blocked out completely. There's always long, painful periods of development. So you have to just forget about it. So I'd written two scripts and also like a series Bible, which is basically an overview of the whole series. And at that point in 2018, that's when we sent the two scripts to Kate to see if she would be interested in playing Phyllis Schlafly. And soon after she came on board is when we were greenlit to go into production.
So was Kate Blanchett I wouldn't expect you to admit it. No, she was our 19th choice, but
she's nobody's 19th choice, of course. She was like 37 after, we were like, we went to 50 other people. No, of course, if you can get Kate, there's no one else.
I mean, did you just think when you were writing it, Phyllis Schlafly, who plays her, Kate Blanchett?
I mean, when you're writing a television series, you never think, will this incredible movie star who's never done television before. I just didn't have the arrogance to think that she would entertain it. But once one of our producers mentioned, what about Kate? I know it's a long shot, but maybe she'll be interested in this. I was like, there's no one better. And also, I do remember when I was writing the pilot that I was concerned that if we didn't get an actor like Kate at her level, that this is a role that could quickly descend in the wrong hands into caricature or, you know, just not be three-dimensional. So it was always in the back of my mind that getting the right actor to play Phyllis Schlafly was key to this series being successful.
Yeah, I mean, Phyllis Schlafly to those of us who remember her, did feel like caricature in the day. You know, it was like, what is this woman and what is her thing? You know, the contradiction is evident in your series from the first episode that she's out there having this career and trying to fight against the Equal Rights Amendment, which actually, as you make the point in the first episode, was not necessarily her priority going in.
That's what I found so fascinating about her. I think if I had looked more into her and found out she was a full-time homemaker and this was her only crusade, I don't think I would have been as excited to write about her. But when I learned that she'd had a 20-year career in defense strategy and her main passion or probably her dream was to work, be appointed to the Pentagon, I'm like, well, this is an interesting person and worthy of digging a little deeper.
And then you have the whole other cast. You have Rose Byrne playing Gloria Steinem. You have Tracy Ullman playing Betty Friedan. And did that just go like boom, 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 boom when you have Cate Blanchett, or did she want to know who else was going to be in the thing?
Once you have Cate, it's boom, 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 pretty much. And also Cate came on as an executive producer and she was involved with casting. And so it really helped us a lot in terms of having access to some of these actresses who maybe wouldn't have considered doing a project like this.
Yes. So you wrote some of the episodes, you brought on a writer's room and then kind of wrote the other episodes and revised the ones you'd written.
So once I wrote the first two episodes before the show was greenlit, and then we opened up the writer's room. And as a team, we broke all the other episodes, and each writer on our staff was assigned an episode to write drafts of. But, you know, obviously with any TV series, especially when you go into production, there's always revisions, you know, to be made. But generally, I thought we had an incredible writing staff, and I think of us like a collective brain, and we all contributed to all the episodes. You know, everyone had a hand in every episode.
No one was like your Betty Friedan and your Bella Abzug.
I mean, we did identify, and apparently I'm Bella Abzug, as I was told. We had Halloween during the writer's room, and everyone was joking about going as one of the characters for Halloween, so everyone was kind of divvying up roles. And I got Bella, which I'm very proud of. It means I have a good hat collection. It means I'm salty. It means I'm very smart and have an advanced degree, which would make my parents very happy because I actually don't have an advanced degree like Bella.
Oh, okay. So you got promoted academically.
I got promoted. Exactly.
Coming up after a short break, Mrs. America creator Davi Waller talks about how her experience as a writer on Mad Men and Desperate Housewives helped shape Mrs. America. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Davi Waller, creator of the new FX on Hulu series, Mrs. America. In the tumultuous 1970s, Phyllis Schlafly's army of housewives busied themselves with the Stop ERA movement, while prominent feminists were focused on winning support from the White House, though they didn't always agree on the best way to get it. In 1972, Shirley Chisholm, the first Black woman elected to Congress, became the first Black woman to run for president. With the Democratic Convention approaching, some feminist leaders, including Betty Friedan, wanted to throw the weight of the movement behind Chisholm. Others, like Congresswoman Bella Abzug, saw Chisholm's low poll numbers and urged her to drop out and endorse George McGovern. In Mrs. America, Margot Martindale plays Abzug and Uzo Aduba plays Chisholm.
If you understood power, you would
understand power. I am trying to protect our interests, put pressure into places that makes real results, not symbolic. I am not going to let your ego get in the way.
Well, my ego... If you were running for president, not only would this entire movement endorse you, we would host fundraisers, knock on doors, make phone calls.
Because I would go about it in the right way.
you know, I'd always studied second wave feminists and they're all painted in the same way. And to learn that they are so diverse and feminist is not a monolithic idea. And there are many different ways, different points of view, even within the movement. I just thought that's cool. And it would be great to dramatize that. So I didn't want to shy away from some of the blind spots and the warts of the feminist leaders. This was 45 years ago. This was just the beginning, the seeds of intersectional feminism, but they didn't even have a word for it back then.
Yeah, I mean, the episode about and the portrayal of Shirley Chisholm is so sad, the way that, well, you know, it's not a new story where there's factions. It happened, you know, in post-Civil War, where the feminists and the advocates for Black rights, African Americans split at a certain point.
That's it's right. Exactly.
Happens again and again. Yeah.
And it just happened in our primary season now. So I think that's the real story, is that there's cycles in history to how progress moves in this country, and it's not linear. And you really see that when you go back to post-Civil War, to the social upheavals of the late 60s. You know, some women came to the feminist movement because they read The Feminine Mystique and they were empowered by that. And some women came to the movement through the civil rights movement. So everyone's coming from a different point of view and has different ideas of the best way to move forward. And this tension between pragmatism and idealism is always a tension in politics. And it was the same for the women's movement.
I imagine it was sort of fun, but not fun to have Roger Stone and Paul Manafort do cameos in, I mean, not the real ones, obviously, since one of them's in prison and the other one's heading that way, maybe, yeah. Probably.
And actually, our Paul Manafort, we had to put him on an Apple box because he wasn't quite the same height of Paul Manafort. He's quite tall. I think for me, it's fun when, you know, like, for instance, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was Brenda Feigenfasto's boss and they went to a meeting together around this time. And so it's fun to just see these people who are now loom so large in our current politics and see where they were 45 years ago. So, and also Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, I didn't know that they were involved in Reagan's campaign. I thought that was really interesting and says a lot about the similarities between 1980 election and 2016 election.
What you're seeing there is the you know, the advent of that kind of culture war that we have really reached a almost hopefully a crescendo of now, and maybe can move beyond in the post-pandemic world.
I hope so. I mean, I thought wedge issues were invented in the 2000s by Karl Rove. So the idea that they were invented in the 70s was news to me. And I thought, wow, that really says a lot.
I was really surprised that Phyllis Schlafly, I read, you know, that her daughter has had something to say about your portrayal of her, and her daughter is still, there's still an Eagle Forum and her daughter is doing it.
That's right. Her daughter's head of the Eagle Forum.
I just thought somehow it would have gone. I mean, that was very naive of me. On the other hand, the Equal Rights Amendment still hasn't passed. So I guess why should the Eagle Forum fold its tent? But I'm not sure of the gist of her complaint. Some people thought you were too favorable to Phyllis Schlafly. I guess she wasn't one of them.
Well, I think if a lot of people are, you know, she was a lightning rod. She was a very polarizing figure. I don't think you can do a series about a woman like that, especially a real life woman, without a lot of people being up in arms about it. And if no one's up in arms about it, then you've probably made something very boring. So I think it's to be expected.
Yeah. Did you ever feel tempted to make it Bella or, you know, Gloria, not Phyllis, not Mrs. America?
I feel like that story has been told. You know, I've seen a lot of documentaries about the women's movement where it's focused primarily on Gloria Steinem or Bella Abzug. And so I feel like that has been done. What I haven't seen a lot of is when I watch films and television series about social movements, they're always from the point of view of the leaders of progress and rarely told from the point of view of the leader of the backlash. So it just seemed like a more exciting or fresher way into this story. And I also, if I focused on Gloria and Bella, I wouldn't have been able to tell the broader story, which I wanted to tell, which is how these fault lines developed in the culture wars of today and the country's move, sharp turn to the right that happened in the 70s. And that story is really needs to be told through Phyllis Schlafly.
I know you did a ton of reading and there's been a lot to read and look at. Did you reach out to Gloria Steinem?
I didn't speak to Gloria Steinem personally. Certainly, we reached out to let her know about the show and that we're doing the show. And I know she was a consultant on a movie about her personal story and several other movies about Bella Abzug. But I felt with this series that in wanting to tell the story from multiple points of view, I felt that we as writers would have been beholden to just one person's point of view of how things went down if we had any of these women be or their children be consultants on the show. That in a way, yes, you limit yourself to telling, then the story would have been Phyllis versus Gloria, and that isn't the story I wanted to tell.
Now, going further earlier in your career, you did Desperate Housewives, which somehow, it seems like it somehow fits in there with the No on ERA movement.
Definitely in terms of, a show that's centered on women, I think Desperate Housewives was one of the early ones. And I guess the women in the suburbs.
Yes. I don't know if that experience in any way fed the portrayal of the women, the homemakers who are Phyllis Schlafly's followers in Mrs. America.
You know, not consciously. I think because this is a true story and about real women, I was so immersed in their actual writings of these women and the material out there about these real life women that I wasn't really drawing on fictional characters of shows I'd worked on. But mm-hmm. that's not to say unconsciously things seep in or experiences you have, seep in. Certainly, I think the experience of working on Desperate Housewives and writing for women who I didn't relate to at all was a great experience in terms of putting yourself in someone's shoes when your experiences are so divergent.
Right, right. Let me go ask about Mad Men, too, which you worked on. I mean, you have mm-hmm. Time's Up issues in Mrs. America, of course, and there was a Time's Up issue on that. Did you manage to just stay out of that? Cater Gordon obviously made an allegation against Matt Weiner. Marty Noxon weighed in, actually, in the world generally and on my show about that, mm-hmm. on taking Cater's side. And I don't know whether you just managed to say, I'm not dealing with this, or whether you took a position or want to take a position.
Yeah, I wasn't on the Mad Men writing staff the season that incident that Cater talks about took place. So no one called me to really weigh in, and I can't really weigh in because I wasn't there for that. I mean, my hope is, I wouldn't want to have publicity around Miss America end up talking about that aspect. So I feel like that's exactly why I wanted to make Miss America, to like have women have voices and not have it become about the men. But I really... I could speak to my experience on Mad Men personally, but not to that particular moment in time because I missed it. I came in season 3.
Well, what did you get out of Mad Men personally? I mean, did that get you to the place where this was your next thing and your idea that you felt the confidence or whatever that it might have contributed to you professionally?
I learned a lot from working on Mad Men about how to portray a historical period and make it feel really authentic. I really took a lot from watching Matt on set and during prep in terms of he was so OCD about getting every detail right, and not just in the scripts, but also in production design, costumes, hair, makeup, everything had to be just so. And it really, when you watch it, it feels like this lived in experience and it feels really authentic. And I brought all of those tools with me when I came to Mrs. America for sure. And also working on Halt and Catch Fire was like another time period. And even though it was fictionalized, the industry and the backstory of the show was all authentic. And so all those experiences were great preparation for doing this.
That is true. These are two huge, now three, with your series, like major period pieces that you've been part of. I mean, do you have something in mind for the next one where you're like, it's going to be now. I'm not going back and doing the hair and makeup.
I definitely saw that. After working on so many historical dramas, they take so much more time and work. And I just was like, I just want to write something today. But of course, then the pandemic hit and you're like, what is that going to even look like? Is everyone going to be wearing masks? Are we going to be in quarantine? Like, to write a show set contemporary world has its own obstacles now that I hadn't even considered. But yes, it'd be very refreshing to work on something that takes place in the 2020s.
Dobby Waller is the creator of Mrs. America, now streaming on Hulu. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kim. It was so good to talk to you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. Special thanks to Mario Diaz for helping us from the studio this week. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.